talk about the film.
Yeah.
Can we talk about 4K Blu-rays?
Yeah, 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 of course.
Have they asked you to consult about the
I've just done it.
Home
I just,
video?
I just finished it.
Yeah. And how long, and what was the, you know that 2001 is being shown.
Yeah.
And it's what they call an original, non-restored.
Yeah, this is, yeah. It's a new internet from the original Interpos that came from the original.
Have you seen what that looks like compared to what the 4K
is? I color timed that too.
Can you give me your estimations of the difference between the two?
Yeah, well, 4K is beautiful. I mean, you get it to see inside the details and the shadows in an incredible way. And of course...
And color gradation too, though.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, absolutely. And, you know, so you can actually... Of course, you can pinpoint areas where, you know, it's too dark or it's too light or whatever. You can just get a little area the size of your thumbnail if you want to.
Where did you see the 4K version? On a screen? How did you look at it?
No, I look at it in a Telecine suite as I'm color timing it.
Where?
I look at it in the color Telecine suite as I'm timing it.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, very, very high resolution monitors.
I would love to see that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, it looks great. Everybody loves it. I mean, they do. I mean, I'm not blowing my own trumpet, but they do. And it is. You realize, you know, digital and film are different animals. You can't compare them. They both have their own charms, you know. And the thing about digital is you can go in and you can, like, as you say, gradate color and density and contrast. You know, film, if you make a change, it's the whole picture. So you're kind of limited much more in film, but you can still get wonderful results out of it, you know, of course, especially if they're shot beautifully in the first place, you know. So,
Do you happen to have a 4K player yourself?
No, I don't. I don't. This is all kind of new.
How big was the monitor that you saw it on?
Monitor? About this big.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was it what you would call like a... From a layman's point of view, I mean, I love the Blu-ray of whatever that year was.
Yeah.
4 years old, 5 years old.
I can't remember when I did that. Yeah, but
I'm very pleased with it.
Yes.
But is it going to be the kind of thing that'll make you go, oh, this is...
I think it will be. Right. I think it really, really will be. It's like when I did the Blu-ray on Barry Lyndon, you know, I was so kind of surprised about, you know, how I thought... We got it as close as we could get it to really good.
Yeah.
And then you get Blu-ray and you suddenly think, oh, there's patterns in that wallpaper. And then you're finding the same thing with this, you know. You're finding the patterns in the rocks, you know.
Very aroused and turned on by the sound on the Blu-ray.
Right.
I don't know, it's hard to describe, but, you know, there was the sound of the drums, the old British military drum. It just is very... It felt fuller. Maybe I was telling myself.
No. I mean, you know, I worked with Chris Jenkins, you know, a wonderful sound mixer,
right,
on all the Kubrick titles. And we did some great work. We restored them all. You know, we went back to the original tracks and rebalanced. And not only two of the movies, you know, that's 2001 and Eyes Wide Shut. They were the only two that the stereo originally.
Okay.
The others were mono, so we went back to the original tracks and we rebuilt them as six, you know, six tracks.
Not to get off my original question.
Yeah.
What is the difference in your mind between this, what they call a old, kind of an original negative version that they're going to show in Cannes, and the skipped up 4K?
What's the difference? For 4K, well, there's more clarity and sharpness and detail. That's what I would say about the 4K.
And so the people seeing it in Cannes in a couple of weeks are going to say, oh, this is wonderful. Not as sharp as it can be.
I have no idea. I really don't know. But it's, you know, it's one of those wonderful things, I think, that people are still absolutely so conscious of that movie. And, you know, and it wasn't just that it was, you know, seminal thing for me, and you find with every generation that sees it, it is for them too. And I just love that. I think it's wonderful, you know. It's a real testament, I think, power of film.
I told you that my father met the guy who played Moonwatcher
Oh, yeah.
At an AA meeting.
Oh, right.
And then I went over to see him at his home in near Sierra Madre in the hills, near Pasadena.
Oh, right.
And at the time, he was dealing with chemo.
Oh, really?
But he apparently got through it.
Oh, great. Okay. Dan Richter, is it? Dan Richter.
And I did a piece eons ago. This was like, we're talking like 92 or something.
Oh, right.
I don't know if he's still with us, but I loved that.
Yeah, yeah. Like, well, see, when I saw it, I was still in drama school, you know, and I went to, you know, it was a drama school, it was very Stanislavski based and all that.
Yeah.
And we did a lot of work around animals and behavior, you know. And when I first saw 2001, I was like, I'll give anything up to be an ape. Yeah, I really would.
Love your column, I read it every day.
Oh, thanks, man.
Hollywood Elsewhere.
Yeah.
Every day.
Thanks for saying that.
Yeah, it's really wonderful. Thank you.
What's your name?
Guy Camilleri.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's nice.
Yeah, I would have. He obviously was at the time, I guess, auditioning mimes. Wasn't that the idea?
Yeah.
Did he get wind of the auditions going on? Did you?
No, I think he was. A lot of them were dancers, and you know, in fact, many of them were dancers. And I think it was Dan Richter sort of had this pool of people who he knew and he probably worked for before.
Yeah.
But for me, the most interesting thing about that is the ape scenes were the last thing that was shot.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. It already shot the rest of the movie.
And at Elm Street, right?
Elm Street is the MGM in Elm Street.
And I never had anybody explain that to me, but why did he go for what was called front projection of the backdrop as opposed to the standard
back projection?
Because it's obviously not something that you are savoring detail from.
No.
Why did he do that?
Well, he said to me, I mean, over the years, kind of asked those questions, or they come up, and he said it was a question of shadow play, you know, it was quite difficult to get shadow free back projection the way he wanted to use back projection.
Mm.
And he said that he found the front projection was much more, you could adapt it much more, you could, you know, you could swing a camera, you could move a camera, and you didn't have that kind of problem. Now, whether that's the whole story, I don't know, but that's the kind of way he explained it to me.
What about the streaming of this 4K? That's what I would think they would hopefully do. Oh,
I'm sure they will.
Is that?
I have no idea what their marketing plan is. You know, I don't. But I'm sure they will. I'm sure it's just becoming something everyone has to do now.
What about? Now we don't. We talked about this last year, but what about their intentions as far as the other Kubrick titles? Are they going to 4K them?
I would imagine over time. I mean, you know, they never did any of it all at once, you know. The only time we ever did all of his movies at once was for the first, well, I say the first, DVD collection. That was the only time it took 3 years, you know. Otherwise, you know, the 4Ks, they were done, you know, one here, one later, one later. Barry Lyndon was the last one we did, and that was many years, well, 2-3 years after Blu-ray, you know, was...
What's the process of them creating 4K? They can't go back to anything that you created for the Blu-ray. They got to do it all over again, right?
We have to do it all over again, yeah.
And back then, they didn't scan for 4K, or, like, for instance, Lawrence of Arabia, way back when,
right,
was scanned at 8, I was told by Bob.
Yeah, it's probably true, yeah. No, they didn't. I mean, this is, you know, this is the first time, I think, you know, that they've even sort of gone so far as to do this with Stanley's films, so, but no, I mean, they can't just click a button and everything shifts over. I mean, with the Blu-ray, I had to redo the Blu-ray, you know, from the original DVDs that I did, in the same way, you know, you have to do it shot for shot, you know.
So it's not an inexpensive process?
No, it's not inexpensive at all, you know.
Yeah.
Each has got its own, what they say, color space, and you can't just, you know, just convert it over to another signal.
Yes.
You have to build it.
Is it Ned Price is still, who's the
Ned guy? Price, yeah, Ned Price, yeah. Yeah, he's great. I mean, he's wonderful, actually.
I got into a thing with him in 2013, because he was one of the people of the guy, along with George Stevens Jr.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they wanted to put out Shane, which was shot in Route 137.
Right.
At 166, apparently because there was some pressure or interest on the part of what they would call the Blu-ray community. They wanted to see it a little closer to the actual 16:9 shape, which I thought was heresy.
Yeah, right, right, I know.
And Ned Price got snitty with me. You know, I don't want to talk to you, all that shit.
Right, right.
And then finally I asked all the big name people if they would voice an opinion. If Woody Allen voiced an opinion, he thought it was ridiculous. Bringing it out of anything other than the original aspect ratio. And they eventually folded their cards. Woody Allen did that.
Right.
But he would just say, fuck you.
It's like, for me, something like that's like the dreaded pen and scan, you know? I mean, it's just heresy, it really is, you know? I'm glad they don't do it anymore, really.
Speaking as one who loves 137, I remember those wonderful Full Metal Jacket and Shining DVDs that were in 137. There was a boxy version.
Yeah. 187.
No, it wasn't in 185. It was
185.
It was the full aspect.
Of course. Yeah. You're right.
15 years ago.
Yes. No. Right. No, I did them. So yeah. Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
Absolutely love looking at films like that.
A lot height.
Of unnecessary headroom. It's great.
Yeah. Absolutely. Because what I thought about Full Metal Jacket in particular was the fact that you kept the height, kept that sort of vulnerability.
Yeah.
Going. In a way that, you know, widescreen didn't, you know? I loved it, yeah, I did too. And it's funny, a lot of people who don't have nothing to do with the film industry, they were saying to me, oh, I saw, because the television were the same, you know, or the TV. And they were saying, do you know, I watched that film, and it was just as strong for me as it was when I saw it in the cinema. And it's because of the height that we got, you know?
Yeah. Do you miss the wonderful, rich architectural life of England? We all love Los Angeles. Where did you live during most, what part of London were you living in during most of your time?
I lived just all over London when I was an actor. I mean, I can't tell you how many addresses I had. Well, I went to live in Stockholm for a few years and came back to England to work. I married a Swedish girl.
Prior to your starting full-time with family?
Yeah.
Okay. And why Stockholm?
Why? Because I met somebody and...
Oh, okay. The mother of your daughter, whom I met last...
That's right, yeah.
Your beautiful daughter.
Yeah. And so I lived there for a while. So when I came back to England, I actually lived in St Albans, which is a town. St Albans is a city just north. Well, it's really becoming London.
Really?
I mean, the spread now is just...
So you look at the Google Maps, it looks fairly green still.
Oh, it is. That's the lovely thing I felt about St Albans, because 2 minutes you're in the countryside, 20 minutes the other way, you're in London. You're in the middle of London. And also, it was a practical thing, because that's where Stanley lived, you know. So when I came back to work for him, you know, it didn't seem sensible to go and work and, you know, live in London. We were way out there. Not on.
No, there's a lot of footage in the film of you and the kids. Intensively working at their office.
Now,
were they living with you physically at one time? Were you splitting custody?
Splitting custody.
Okay.
So the agreement was that they would come and live with me during their vacations, school vacations, and then, you know, for the rest of the time, obviously, they lived in Stockholm. And, you know, that worked for a long time. And Stanley was great, you know. Whenever they wanted to come, and he'd hijack them, take them into the kitchen.
This is actually,
he'd hijack them, take them into the kitchen. He'd always say, do you want some tea and toast? And off they'd go. And an hour and 2 hours later, I'd go into the kitchen to give him some stuff or information. And they were just sitting around the table, the three of them, just talking. Amazing. Yeah, he had such a kind of contact.
You know, when I'm listening to you now, your voice has a softer, quality than what I heard on the dock. You have a wonderful voice that comes from years of cigarettes.
Yes, sir.
A great sounding voice. And it really bears no resemblance to your voice as you had in Barry Lyndon.
Right.
What a great voice that I've heard. Yeah, this is what Los Angeles.
Yeah, I know.
Fire engines,
yes.
Traffic.
I know. Yeah.
Anyway, I love the sound of it, and it's. How many years were you still smoker?
Yeah, but not as heavy. Yeah. I mean, at my height with Stanley, you're really talking 3 packs a day.
Really?
Yeah. For years, I was smoking 3 packs a day.
Anxiety. The pressure.
Yeah, it was just one after the other, yeah. You know, absolutely.
Did he ever caution you and tell you?
No, he used to sneak one off me every now and then.
Uh-huh.
We'd be, you know, he had this rooms that sort of faced onto his back lawn, and we'd be standing there, you know, smoking a cigarette, and if Christiana came anywhere near us, you know, suddenly I had 2 cigarettes in my hand. Oh, wow.
Anyway, I've always loved also Stanley's voice. I remember the big shock when I first heard his voice, which sounded to me like a Bronx cab driver.
Yeah.
A cultured Bronx cab driver.
Yeah.
Thoughtful, educated, the guy who grew up in the Bronx and talked like a real New Yorker. Totally.
Absolutely, yeah.
Loved the sound.
He never really lost that. He never lost that. You know, we used to, I mean, we used to do a lot of color. He taught me about color timing. I mean, it was a real sit down, and I'd have the timing sheets, and we'd go through a film frame by frame. And in between each reel, we'd kind of sit down, and suddenly we could be talking about anything. It could be soccer, politics, anything, you know? And he had this cadence, which was really very attractive, you know? And also he was very sort of direct. And so it made conversation really kind of, forget all the crap, it was, you know, down to the bone of what it is you were talking about. And I miss things like that. I still miss it. I mean, to this day, you know.
You say in the film that there was a, you noticed right near the end, that Stanley was feeling very tired.
Right. Yeah. Yes, he was. He was.
Did you have any inkling that he might be at death's door or ill in some way? Or?
No, absolutely not. And, you know, it's kind of a hard... It's such a hard thing to describe. I mean, in Film Worker, it's kind of, you know, it's 80 minutes and you have to condense so much and you have to, and then of course there's hours and hours and hours of stuff that didn't get in there, I suppose. But what I found about that time was
very
that
hot.
Stanley, it was such a sort of slow progressive thing where you saw him, I saw him getting, you know, more and more fatigued and a little, you know, tired at the end.
Towards the end of...
Yeah, at the end of shooting, you see, because, I mean, we were wrapping sometimes 2 or 3 in the morning, you know, and Stanley and I were always the last ones out because we'd look at stuff at the end of the day, you know, we'd talk about stuff, you know, who do we like today and who didn't we like today, that kind of thing, you know. But I really started noticing that it was... he was laboring a little by the end of it, and the... You know, the editing process was pretty heavy duty, you know, and it got worse and worse in a way, his tiredness, but it was an absolute shock. I didn't realize. I mean,
and where were you when you heard of this?
I was at home and I was just about to come in and the book of the script. And I'd been talking with him on the Saturday night. Well, Saturday evening, actually. We were on the phone for about an hour and a half, and he actually sounded pretty perky, you know, pretty good, you know.
Yeah.
But Sunday, I, you know, suddenly around about noon, I'd heard, you know, you shouldn't come in, you know, something's happened. And I guessed that something had happened. And I got another phone call, you know, which told me that it had happened. And, And you know, the funny thing about that was the police came, of course, you know, with the ambulance and what have you, because it was so...
Did you drive out to St. Albans when you heard?
Sorry?
Did you drive out to St. Albans?
Oh, yeah.
And the police came because...
The police came, well, because it was such a sudden death, you know, and the ambulance was there and all the rest of it. And the thing is that because they'd been involved, there was a deadline, 4 o'clock, when they would have to release the news.
Yeah, it
was just one of those things. Reuters, actually, who they do. And so it was a real scramble to get hold of Tom and Nicole and kind of warn them what was going to be coming up, you know. It was a terrible day, I must say.
How many times did you wind up going to the Lotma exhibit during its... How long was it there? For about 9 months or 8 months?
What?
The Los Angeles County Museum exhibit.
In the end. Oh, God. I never counted. But it's got to be more than a dozen times, you know, with people who wanted to...
I heard that his daughter, I've forgotten her, you know, the Scientology...
Vivian.
That she went a lot, I heard. Not true?
I don't know, because... You know, the show's been traveling, so she may have seen it when it was in Florida, for all I know. I don't know. I have no idea.
Does she still... She doesn't live here, you're saying?
Or? No, she doesn't live here. No,
not for a long time.
No. I think she went to Texas and lived there for a little while, and now she's in Florida.
Right.
Although she may not be there now,
because
I don't know.
Because of Scientology?
No. She moved from L.A. because of pollution. She couldn't stand the pollution, you know.
Right.
But no, but Scientology just seems to be, you know, everywhere she goes. I mean, it is. It's pretty pernicious, really. Yeah.
I would really love to see it one more time in a theatrical sense. I told her. I'm sorry that I'm going to be. It's going to be, however, playing at the Metro Graph. Right? Is that what it's called?
Where?
I think it's called the Metrograph, the downtown. Doesn't it open there?
I've been told Newark.
Oh no, here, yes.
Yeah.
Newark. I'm talking about in Manhattan.
In Manhattan. I don't know. I've just been told to be prepared to travel. I don't even know the exact date it's going to happen.
Yeah.
You know. But I mean. I think, you know, film like Film Worker, it sounds so obvious, but I think it's quite a different kind of film for people to watch. I mean, most documentaries are about the big heroes and, you know, the stars and the filmmakers and the, you know, captains of industry.
The central idea of Film Worker seems to be that when you have found something that is clearly a source of profound satisfaction.
Right.
That's really the all of what life is. I mean, obviously, you want children, you want love, you want good food, but the source of the
water in the morning,
profound satisfaction that I could feel from you throughout the entire thing, I felt that was such a sublime thing, because you don't really commune with that kind of, we'll call it what you want, worship, or, you know.
Well, that for me is it. I mean, it truly is, you know. And I have so many people I have to be thankful for, you know, in my life. Like, you know, my English lit teacher, who just loved literature. She was one of these people, BA Oxford, and, you know. And then I went to drama school and I met this guy that kind of taught me how to harness all that. You know, it's not out there like that, it's like this. And from there you kind of, you know, you go into all sorts of analysis. In your mind, as well as, you know, actually dealing with texts and what have you, plays and what have you. And so it gave me such a firm grounding, and it just made me realize that, you know, it's the same for anything. Once you get into something and really get into something, then I'm in heaven. I mean, I'm in heaven. I really am. When I was doing these transfers now of the 4K and the 2001s, nothing else existed. Nothing else existed, you know. It's just so in there. You're in there, and yeah. It's no contest, you know.
Did you do you think that had Stanley committed to the Aryan Chronicles? Is that what it was called?
Aryan Papers.
Papers.
Yeah.
Which was going to be rather my failing to summarize it. Could you please just tell me what the Aryan Papers, the arc of it was going to be?
Right, right. Well, the Aryan Papers, and I think he was actually going to, he called it Aryan Papers because Warner Brothers wanted to do it, say, you know, call it that, but we were going to go back to Wartime Lies, which is the original book title.
And color, is that the idea?
We wanted to do is find a way of shooting it or processing it, so it was very much like those documentaries that you get of World War II in color, for instance. It's such a particular weird kind of color, but it works somehow. It sort of puts you in a different age, you know. And the story, you know, the whole thing was, you know, when Stanley wrote a script, you probably, that isn't the script you ended up with by the time you finished shooting. I mean, nothing was the same, you know. And the story in the original story, what he wanted to deal with was, the book is about the memory of a young boy.
Memory,
what he remembers, and how it can be deadly accurate, and it can be way, way out there, more to do with his psyche than what he actually saw or what he actually experienced.
Why are we sharing his memory in the context of the film? What's the...
Because it was the basis of it was because ever since they went through what they went through in the war, they've always met. He met his aunt and I think his father at the same place every year to commemorate the fact that they were still together.
Right.
And it was it's like a little bit like, I don't know if you ever read a book called The War and Modern Memory, which is a World War One. It's all about World War One. Paul Fussell, wonderful book, you know. And it's a little bit...
The War and Modern Memory.
Modern Memory. God, I mean, he must have written it in the early 60s, I think, you know. And I loved that book. It was so great. I read it. It was one of the first books, grown-up books I read from cover to cover, you know. And it is. It's that thing, you know, that memory isn't always, you know, factual. Memory can sometimes be so, what can you call it, expressionistic somehow, and impressionistic. It can be anything. And if it's relates to the way you feel, it's always a way like physicalizing emotion, you know. And I think that's very much kind of that. Direction Stanley wanted to take that.
You know, the
story.
Recollection that this man, thinking back to his was mostly about him and his mother?
His aunt.
His aunt.
Yeah, yeah.
Because
how on their way to get out of Poland, she actually, you know, she went through hell. I mean, it was amazing.
Yeah.
She had, you know, she had relationships with Germans and, you know, officers. And it was just, you know, whatever you could do to survive. And it was a wonderful story, Survivor, and incredible.
And the development was in 89, 90 or something?
Yeah, it was. And then Schindler's List came along.
That's what did it,
because, you know, I always used to joke that when Stanley started on a movie, say like Full Metal Jacket, by the time we'd finished it, there'd been a whole bunch of Vietnam movies made, shot, and edited in the time it took us to do pre-production, you know. And Schindler's List came along, and it was so hugely successful. It really was. And it's one of those things, Hollywood has this funny thing, you know, which is, well, we've already got a film about, you know, the Holocaust. Or, you know, we wanted to make a film when I was working with Todd Field. We wanted to make a film about a book from a book called The Persian Bride, which is a wonderful story about a teenager who does a year sabbatical and he goes to Iran. And he doesn't quite understand what the draw is. So the whole story is getting to that point of now we know what it is that pulled him there. And when we were doing it, trying to get it developed, all we got was, oh, but there's always already an Arab story, you know, like The Kite Runner. You know, and you think, well, they're not Arabs, you know, but it's just the fact that it's in the Middle East. You know, we've got one of those films, so, you know, forget it, you know. And I think, so he kind of felt that too, you know, he kind of missed the cycle. I'm sure that would have come up again. I really am. He would have come up later, just like eyes wide shut, really.
What were you actually working on with Todd when you guys were together?
Little Children. And so I was an associate producer on that. And
were there other projects you guys were?
Well, while I was still working, I always say I was working for Stanley, and I say that now.
Yeah.
When I did his transfers, I was working for Stanley, you know.
Yeah.
He made his first film in the bedroom, you know. What I did, because he was a friend, I kind of got, you know, like lab deals, and, you know, I kind of put him in the way of all the sort of people I'd be working with and had relationships with. And then when I finished with Warner Brothers, then I started working with Todd, you know, for DreamWorks. Actually, we had a contract with DreamWorks, and we made Little Children.
I really don't want to see him disengage any longer. He's been away for too long.
Yeah, I know. And it is a shame.
If he has to make something for Netflix or people,
I just
want to see
anything.
Him back.
Yes, I know.
Doing what I became accustomed to. He's really a voice.
Yes, he
really
is. Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I don't know. I kind of think that. I think he bruises easily, you know, and it's such a brutal process.
He's living there?
No. I mean, he lives on the East Coast. You know.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
But he, you know, it's if you're very sensitive, it's a horrible kind of process you have to go through sometimes.
Yeah.
Especially if, you know, I think a lot of people sort of say, "Oh, Stanley, you know, he could do anything and what have you," and there's a certain amount of envy that goes with it. But I tell you, we had to fight every time we did a new release. You know, we had to fight exactly the same way, you know, for posters, for, you know, advertising, all that kind of stuff, you know. I mean, it was a battle. It really was, you know. And so, it wasn't easy for any. It's never easy for anyone, really. But it's harder for somebody who's coming up in the studio, actually has more of a hold on your picture, you know, than you do, you know.
You know, before I heard the title of the doc, I don't honestly believe that I've ever heard the term film worker. Is that a term that is in England that you hear from time to time?
No.
Is this an original WU?
I tell you what it was. That I was living in Stockholm and I was working in the industry there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd been working on as an actor up to that point. And when I was flying back to England, you know, I used to have to fill in these little piece of things, you know, on the plane. And I wasn't an actor anymore, but I'd worked with casting, you know, and I'd worked in production in Sweden, you know, doing everything, I suppose. And I thought, well, I don't know what to call myself. And so I said film worker because, you know, that's what I would have called myself in Sweden, film arbetare, you know. But I just said film worker, you know, that's what I am and that's what I do. I work with film. I've got no specific, you know, I'm not an actor, I'm not a casting director. So I just called myself film worker. And I think one of the wonderful things I heard was that there'd been a bunch of people from DreamWorks who'd seen the movie, and they decided they were going to call themselves doing film workers, you know. I think that was a lovely idea.
Yeah.
I mean, But it's funny, it sort of puts me where I am in the process, you know. It's not specific, it can be anything. And,
Just to peer back, I'm sorry to be sound obsessive, but you've not had any conversations that indicate to you whether Price or anybody at the did you ever talk with George Feltenstein over there? He's kind of an archive.
No, I had one conversation I think with him.
But why don't they talk about for those who don't want to plunge and buy a 4K machine, which that includes me,
I don't
think there's enough good stuff out there. It's only
I know.
I mean, if they had 10 of the films of the quality of Barry Lyndon for it, I'd probably buy a 4K.
Right.
But aren't they going to, why don't they just talk about a date when they're going to start streaming it instead of being vague about it?
Yeah, I know. Well, it's all, you know, I think one of the most overused words I hear in, you know, film studios and about production and what they're doing here is the word teaser. Teaser, you know, that they think you tease the public with something and so it gets them interested and gets them going, which I guess, computers really had that kind of thing too, streaming and all that. They were, you know, small things that grew and they kind of teased the public with them. And I think there's a little bit of a hangover with that way of thinking. I really do. And also, you know, there's a reluctance to sort of, I don't know what it is. I think so many times when Hollywood comes with a new product, wherever in the marketplace it is, you know, it's so full on that 2 months later, there's something else that absolutely pushing it out, you know. And Stanley, when we marketed, you know, Stanley was very conscious of not letting it all go at once. He wanted to keep it, you know, slower process and, you know, and use the time, you know, not hysterically, but kind of thoughtfully. And I think there's, you know, there's a lot in that, you know.
Now, as you know, that they're going to theatrically put 2001 into theaters in next month.
Yeah, so I heard, yeah.
A few here and there.
Yeah.
And, but one thing that I had in my mind a long time ago, I happened to attend an IMAX, special IMAX demonstration show. Ron Howard and Tom Hanks were there, and they were showing an up-resed version.
All right.
You know, obviously it started at 35, but I was astonished how great that was.
Uh-huh.
From that moment on, I mean, this is just a couple of scenes from Apollo
13.
From that moment I said, you know, they should do an up-res 2001 and show it on a huge...
Yeah, we were going to see, after Stanley died and I came over here to start all the work on the restorations of his camera negatives and everything, they came and they wanted, you know, IMAX wanted to do it so much. They really wanted to do
it. When was that? When
this would have been 1999, 2001.
Right.
Yeah. And of course, you know, there's an anniversary going on in 2001. It's because of the title. And it ended up, they ended up doing another movie. I can't remember what it was. I think they kind of felt like they were going to have to go through a lot of hoops and jumps and, you know, and, you know, I guess one of the reputations Stanley had was that he never did anything quickly, you know, everything was very considered and slow. And then, of course, the 2001 date came and they kind of just decided to release a 70mm print. But I got to tell you, they had one theater in New York and I would not have known it was happening until I got an email from someone. You know, it was like there was nothing. I think it was, I didn't even see newspaper ads or anything. There may have been one or two, but not much. But, you know, the IMAX thing, I was really excited about, but it never happened, sadly.
I think at that, you know, everything goes cost too much, and they think it's this limited, you know, fan base audience, but it's really one of the few films that really deserves to be shown on an IMAX.
I agree.
Delighted to.
Yeah, I agree.
By the way, what is being re-released to, I don't know, what, 5 theaters or 10 theaters? They're doing some kind of limited.
Doing some kind of limited,
But the basis of it is the remastering for the 4K, yes?
Yeah.
It's not a 70mm film projected.
I don't think so, but I can't be sure because, you know, we've done this 70mm version from this new negative.
Yeah.
Whether they just take that and, you know, put it into 4K, I do not know. I have no idea what they plan with that, you know. But it seems kind of, well, we've done a 4K telecine, you know, why do both with, you know, to achieve the same aim? I don't know. I have no idea.
I have now seen Filmworker 2.5 times.
Oh, wow.
And I think I'm going to go see, I'm going to Manhattan next Monday. I think I'm going to either catch a screening at the Metrograph or...
Right.
I've just broke my heart when you told me there might be an Academy screening.
Yeah, that's what you said, right?
Roughly, do you know when that might be?
Oh, no, because...
Sometime in May, or...?
Probably, I don't know, yeah. Yeah, everything seems to be happening in May time, because that's when they're sort of releasing it, setting it free. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know what you call it anymore. Release is the wrong word. It sort of seeps out, or all these outlets, and you know.
You know, you're very open and articulate in private conversation, but I get you're like me. You're not much of a social.
No, not really.
You know. Working the party circuit and, you know.
No, I never really was. I mean, when I was young, I was, you know. But I don't know. First of all, when I really got into this working mode with Stanley, you know, there wasn't time for it anyway.
Right.
You know, and, you know, there were odd times, you know, odd days when you let your hair down and get loose, but, you know, it never sort of just seemed to get kind of pointless, you know, in a way. So, you know, it was a gradual evolution, I think.
I obviously get this from Sasha, but just to recount, Kino is going to make the Blu-ray of Filmworker available in the summer?
I have no idea about that kind of schedule, you know. It's in a way, see, it's like, you know, when they came to me and they said they wanted to make Filmworker, you know, Tony Zier and Liz Joffe, you know, I just said, I'm not going to have anything that I'm going to interfere. I'm not going to, you know, sort of say, you've got to have this, you've got to have that. Because it was his film. It was their film, you know. And I've always kind of thought it was really weird when people have to send a list of questions in to be approved by whoever they're interviewing. It seems crazy to me. And that's why you end up with talking heads, I think, in a lot of these things. They are just talking heads, you know. So I sort of just absolutely left it to them, absolutely. The first time I saw anything was just a cut before we took it to Cannes. And then I've seen it two or three times, but no more than that. Kind of sit it out.
I think I've mentioned this also or asked you, but there must be a trove of great material that just didn't fit the narrative of the doc. No, is there going to be extras on the...
Sure, I've no idea. I know he wants to make a film about why Stanley would have wanted to make Eyes Wide Shut. I know that's something he really wants to do. He's going to call it SK-13. So that would have been a 13th film. But other than that, I don't know what his plans are, or what the plans are for this. It's kind of, I find out, you know, I get an email saying I'm going to do this or do that, you know. Then it's a bit weird to be on the other end of it, actually.
Your talent.
I've always thought that was such a weird word whenever it was used, you know, when I first went to Burbank and worked there. And
Would you mind giving me the email of the director so I can ask if he knows?
Oh, no, no.
I won't. I'll be properly discreet about it. I just want to...
Well, do you know something? Yeah, ask Sasha. I think you should ask Sasha.
Oh, I will ask.
Yeah. It's just that he's
doing interviews, of course.
Yeah, he'll be doing interviews, yeah. Yeah. He's coming to do interviews. He's just not in the country at the moment.
Does he live here back in?
No, he's... They live in Boston, but he's been in Egypt because he's got his mother's there and what have you, and then also in Amsterdam to do the final mix and all the rest of it. And so he's not here at the moment. He's coming in for New York, I think, when they do it in New York.
Is there a chance that, under any circumstance, I could see a high-def version of those old boxy versions of The Shining?
Probably. I probably got a DVD set at home.
Yeah, but that's 480p,
That's what?
480p, that's standard definition that we're talking about.
Yeah, standard definition, yeah. Blu-ray? Is that what you want to see?
That's what I'm wondering. I would love to see that old...
I'll give you a set of Blu-rays.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'll give you a set of Blu-rays, okay, yeah, so sure. Absolutely.
Well, that's very enlightening.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
How do we manage that?
Give me your address, I'll send them to you.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah. Do you want me to
Yeah.
Send you an email and tell you.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Do that. Send me an email. Give me your address and I'll send
it. That's a neat little book. Is that your address?
No, it's my... I've got about 100 of these, which over the years, I used to get, New Yorker and they used to send these things out. And I've just used them as notebooks. I've got everything in there from thoughts to how to make a good chicken Kiev and people's addresses and,
In front of my living room couch, I have a large wooden chest that I put my feet up on.
Right.
And in it, and I'm talking about, I had about 80, 75, 90 maps of all the major cities, including Hanoi, and it just picked it up over the years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And my wife Tatiana said, "Chef, you never look, I said, you're completely right, but you're saying you want to get rid of it, but it took me so many years to collect all these."
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
"Chef, you never look, ever, So she, you don't need them, but I was heartbroken when I gave them up.
Oh, you gave them up?
I just dumped them because I figured I'm never going to look at them.
No, I know.
That's heartbreaking.
I got tons of stuff like that, believe me, I really have. I really have. Oh, boy. Yeah.
And it's so simple and easy. I love being able to find my way around various parts of Europe. With Google Maps, I never get lost anymore.
No, no.
There's something about the romance of almost getting lost and being not sure.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I remember when I went to drama school in London, I'd been to London, but only on day trips and stuff like that. And I started walking around London. I didn't know it, but what was beautiful was discovering how Kensington seeped into Victoria, that seeped into Westminster, and suddenly you're finding roads. Oh, that actually could go down to Downing Street or Whitehall, so it's like a slow understanding of the geography of the place, which is so charming about anywhere you go, I think, I went to Miami earlier in the year, and there was this fantastic area. It was bought by a whole street, which a multi-millionaire had bought, and he turned the whole... I wish I could remember what the area was called now, but he turned it over to the arts, basically, and people who wanted to work in the arts. So every single house, it's got its own kind of design and paint job and God knows what, and then set off in various sort of areas, or gallery areas, where they change the exhibitions almost every month. Every month they change the exhibitions, what have you. It's such a beautiful area, it's fantastic. And I can't say I cared for anything else in Miami particularly, to be honest, I thought Miami Beach was just kind of over the top when it came down to it. It was weird.
But, by the way, I read something just a couple of days ago. I had never read this before. Jan Harlan has allegedly a copy of The Pie Fight in Strangelove, and he's going to give it to his kids, and they are free to do what they want. Have you ever heard that?
I've not heard that. I found, for about a year, I was having to, part of what I did was, Stanley had this stable block on his property, a big, big stable block, and it was full of everything, actually, but, a lot of the film, which he didn't use, the outtakes and what have you, they were kind of stacked in there, and he wanted me to go through it, and then we burnt 90% of it. And I found this pie scene.
How long was it, roughly?
About 3 minutes, 4 minutes.
Three, four minutes,
yeah.
And it was cut together?
Yeah, yeah. It was actually cut off the end of the, because they did sort of have a screening, an official screening of it. And so we watched it together. And when it finished, Stanley said, "Oh, thank God we cut that out." He was so, because they cut it out because of Kennedy assassination.
Knowing Stanley for being such an immersive and detail-minded director, you would think there were... I know that he was never, ever in favor of extras and all that.
No, no, he wasn't.
But you'd think that there was some part of him that just... He had invested himself so completely in so many... aspects. You'd think he'd want to share that on some level.
I know.
Because he's such a detailed guy.
I know. But he didn't.
But he didn't.
No, he didn't. No, and you know, I sometimes felt that too, you know, that if it'd been... Well, everyone else does it, I kind of thought, so why don't you, you know? But he wouldn't. He went to extraordinary lengths to stop that kind of thing from happening. He really, really did, you know? Which just made me kind of love him even more, really, which is, you know... No, he was, yeah, amazing. Amazing.
Might we take a couple shots?
No, please do. You know...
I love your... How many nib caps do you have? That's kind of the singer's thing.
I've got 5.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Well, I'll let you go.
Okay. Well, thank you, Jeffrey.
I really appreciate your offer.
Yeah, I'll do that.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I promise you.
Call you and I'll write you and remind you.
Okay. Yeah.
Are you going to go to New York at all?
Yes, I'm going to the screening there. I might see you at the... Metro.
When are you going to be there?
I don't know yet, because they're still coming back to me with travel details and, you know, because there's a lot of stuff that they're kind of doing on the fly now. It kind of feels like they, I don't know, everything is sort of being, oh my God, got to do this, got to do that.
Mm-hmm.
We're all 11,000 people, I think. That's what it is. You know. It's like everything's left at the last minute. So I have no idea.